What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is United States Congresswoman Martha McSally. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. There's been lots of news this week about President Obama's potential nuclear deal with Iran, a 15-year pact between the U.S. and the other big six nations, Russia, China, France, England, Germany, and the European Union, and the Iranian terrorist sponsors themselves. The agreement comes in the face of strong Saudi Arabian and especially Israeli opposition, much of it voiced eloquently by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu in his recent address to the joint houses of Congress. The deep concern voiced on the subject by so many Jewish organizations and the contentious personal relationship between Barack Obama and Bibi Netanyahu lead me to believe it's time to spend a few moments talking about the unique relationship between the U.S. and Israel over the years and the important role U.S. presidents have played in forging that relationship. I can promise that you'll hear virtually every candidate for President of the United States in 2016 talking glibly about the remarkable connection between America and Israel, and refer to Israel as a special, pivotal, and loyal ally in the Middle East, the only true democracy in the region, and a bastion of freedom and Western values. All of this is certainly true, but it's also true that the relationship between the U.S. and Israel has not always been close, and over the years it has progressed through a complex series of historical events, policy and party changes, and varying personal relationships to become a foundational part of American foreign policy, and of American and Israeli domestic politics as well. So how did a tiny country 7,000 miles away become perhaps the most loyal U.S. ally? First, you have to know that in 1947, when the UN was voting to partition the British colony of Palestine into two areas, one Jewish to become Israel and the other Arab to become something as yet unnamed, the U.S. government was split on whether Israel should declare independence or not. The U.S. State Department recommended against forming a new Jewish nation, preferring a UN trusteeship. It advised President Truman not to engage in any military intervention in support of the Jews. The U.S. military assessment was that the odds on the Jews winning the war against multiple Arab armies plus the Palestinian natives wasn't great. The U.S. government was also worried even then about Arab oil. In spite of this, and maybe because of his own friendship with a Jewish partner from his business days named Eddie Jacobson, plus the intervention of Israeli Prime Minister Chaim Weizmann, Harry Truman made certain that the U.S. was the very first nation to recognize Israel, May 14, 1948, shortly after David Ben-Gurion declared independence in Tel Aviv. But it took almost 20 years before the U.S. really became a close ally of Israel. In American military history, the Korean War is the forgotten one, but in Israel, it is the 1956 Suez War that saw Israel allied with Britain and France against Egypt. The Egyptian dictator Nasser closed the Suez Canal and Israel's access to the Red Sea, the Straits of Tehran. The conflict was fought to open the Suez Canal and those straits so Israel could receive essential goods and so Europe could get oil. Wasn't a long war, but after Nasser's Egyptian army was almost totally whipped, America forced Israel and its British and French allies to cease fire and withdraw. President Dwight Eisenhower was no friend to what he viewed as a colonial war, and his support for Israel was very tepid. In later years, Eisenhower would state that forcing Israel, Britain, and France to withdraw from Sinai and the Suez Canal in a humiliating fashion was his worst error in office. Until the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel's main arms supplier was France, not the U.S.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
Well, it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy for me.
Things started to improve in Israeli-American relations under John F. Kennedy when the Cold War dynamics of the region mediated that the U.S. develop a closer relationship with its most reliable ally in the Middle East, Israel. Kennedy ended the U.S. arms embargo on Israel, in place since 1947, but he was strongly opposed to nuclear proliferation. He tried hard to keep Israel from developing the bomb, while France was actually helping Israel do so clandestinely. That was a sharp point of contention between Israel and the U.S. during JFK's short period in office. The real sea change in U.S.-Israel relations began under President Lyndon Johnson. LBJ came from a small, very pro-Zionist Protestant sect in Texas, the Christadelphians, who believed strongly that Jews were God's chosen people and that it was each member's responsibility to look out for them. Johnson had helped save German Jews from Hitler before the war, and his presidency saw a growing warming of the alliance between Israel and America. After Kennedy's assassination in 1963, Johnson said to an Israeli diplomat, "You have lost a very great friend, but you have found a better one." Johnson was true to his word, and the U.S.-Israel alliance grew stronger and closer at every level. The miraculous Six-Day War victory for Israel in 1967 was celebrated in the Johnson White House, and it was LBJ who first made the U.S. Israel's principal supplier of foreign aid and eventually military materiel.
Hello.
Mr. President?
Yes.
This is Dick Nixon.
Yes, Dick.
Unlike Johnson, Richard Nixon certainly was not known for liking Jews. In fact, he was an anti-Semite. But that never prevented him from providing strong support to Israel or having his Jewish Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, help save Israel during the Yom Kippur War by airlifting ammunition. In spite of the Arab oil embargo of 1973 and subsequent efforts to use the oil weapon against Israel, the U.S.-Israel relationship continued to grow and deepen. Even the presidency of Jimmy Carter, a strong supporter of Palestinian national rights, did not diminish the continued development of that relationship. And it was Carter who helped close the deal on the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty at Camp David, and who banned U.S. corporate cooperation with the Arab boycott of Israel.
The first document that we will sign is entitled "A Framework for Peace in the Middle East, Agreed at Camp David." And the text of these two documents will be released tomorrow. The documents will be signed by President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin, and it will be witnessed by me.
Under Ronald Reagan, widely beloved today in Israel, the history was also mixed. He certainly knew how to sound ringing phrases that praised both countries and the alliance.
We're proud to stand beside you this morning, joining a tradition of hospitality for Israel observed by our presidents for more than three decades. I welcome this chance to further strengthen the unbreakable ties between the United States and Israel and to assure you of our commitment to Israel's security and well-being. What we hold in common are the bonds of trust and friendship, qualities that in our eyes make Israel a great nation.
But Israeli journalist Chaim Shalev wrote a famous piece about Reagan 4 years ago, comparing his record on Israel with Obama's, called "If Obama Did What Reagan Did to Israel, He'd Be Impeached." Reagan, who never visited Israel, was often harsh in his criticism of Israeli Prime Ministers Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, both of whom he despised. His comments when Israel destroyed the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, it was a tragedy. It was also under Reagan that the American who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, was prosecuted with the utmost harshness and with great criticism for his Israeli handlers. But under Reagan, this criticism was balanced by ever-increasing arms and foreign aid packages for Israel and lots of that ringing rhetoric. You know, the first president, George Bush, was not considered a friend to Israel. He was an oil company president with close ties to the Arab world. His Secretary of State, James Baker, once said of the Jews, "Bleep them. They don't vote for us anyway," and he was actually hated in Israel. I witnessed that sentiment firsthand when I lived there. But it was also Bush and Baker who created the Madrid Conference that led to the Oslo Accords. Presidents in the last 20 years have been very, very pro-Israel. Bill Clinton had a close relationship with Israel, was revered there, and vastly increased U.S. cooperation with Israel. He movingly eulogized Yitzhak Rabin just after his assassination.
Yitzhak Rabin was my partner and my friend. I admired him, and I loved him very much. Because words cannot express my true feelings, let me just say, Shalom, Haver. Goodbye, friend.
The second Bush, George W. Bush, started out his tenure as a mystery on Israel issues, but he ended it as perhaps the most reflexively pro-Israel president in all of U.S. history.
We consider the Holy Land a very special place, and we consider the Israeli people our close friends. Shalom.
Today, it is nearly unimaginable that a U.S. president would not be tremendously pro-Israel, and there is an entire Congress that has similar views to make certain of that. Cooperation in the areas of the military, intelligence, economics, technology, and culture is greater than it has ever been, and that's true right now under Obama. And while the special relationship phrase is used to characterize the U.S.-England connection, it probably applies better today to the U.S. and Israel. It is likely that more members of Congress have been to Israel than have been to Canada or Mexico. So, is this exceptionally close bilateral relationship, which has come so far since the early days of the Jewish state, proof against a bad deal to try to stop Iran from getting nuclear weaponry? No. After all, one bomb on one missile is all it would take to annihilate Tel Aviv and central Israel and create a new Holocaust and trigger a true nuclear war that would also destroy most of Iran. We need to know if this agreement can be verified and if it will actually work before it becomes law. But it is just as worthwhile to know that our American relationship with Israel has developed over time to the point where there is a great deal of trust and mutual support. That relationship is now so strong it will survive much greater challenges than the personal animus between a president and a prime minister. I don't know if this new Iran deal is a good idea or not. I'll wait to see what people with more expertise think, and then, of course, I will pile on. In the meantime, the Israeli-American relationship is very, very strong today, and it took a long time and a lot of work to achieve this alliance of historical depth and value that will not be damaged easily or soon. To play us in this morning on the theme of friendship and as a tribute to the U.S. relationship with Israel, here's a classic Shlomo Carlebach tune, Laman Achai V'Re'ai, because of my brothers and friends and allies.
Laman Achai V'Re'ai, Laman Achai V'Re'ai, Adabrana, Adabrana, Shalom ba leman achai v're'ai leman achai v're'ai adabra na adabra na Shadow.
That was the legendary Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach singing Laman Achai V'Re'ai. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish, we'll meet our special guest, Congresswoman Martha McSally, perhaps the best qualified person in the entire U.S. Congress to discuss strategic issues dealing with security in the Middle East. Find out what she thinks about the new nuclear deal with Iran when we come back here on Two Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501. A fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish. Our special guest this morning, Congresswoman Martha McSally, represents Arizona's 2nd Congressional District in the United States House of Representatives. She's on the Committees on Armed Services and Homeland Security, is the chair of the Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Communications. Prior to serving in Congress, Representative McSally served 26 years in the U.S. Air Force, retiring in 2010 as a full colonel. She's the first female fighter pilot to fly in combat and the first to command a fighter squadron in combat in United States history, and has a great deal more Air Force history. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rabbi Kohan. I appreciate it.
Delighted to have you. I want to move immediately to kind of the hottest topic, the nuclear deal with Iran. For listeners of Two Jewish who care deeply about Israel, what do you think this deal means?
Well, I am deeply concerned about what I've heard so far on the provisions that are in the deal. It's 155 pages, and I will be reading it here in the next couple days. And I want to make sure that I am able to study all the details of it. But my initial concerns on the sort of strategic overview of it, I have deep concerns about where this is taking us. It legitimizes the largest state sponsor of terrorism with the potential to get a nuclear weapon if they don't cheat in a decade or so. It lifts the arms embargo, which was kind of a new twist since the last framework agreement, which already was problematic in and of itself. I'm still concerned about anywhere, anytime inspections. I'm concerned about access to military bases. I'm concerned about them admitting their past nuclear work. We need to have them fess up, because if they were able to cheat in the past, then they'll be able to cheat again. I am, deeply concerned that the timing of the sanctions being listed, and, this state sponsor of terror that is destabilizing the Middle East, continuing to provide weapons and training to non-state actors like Hezbollah, Hamas, the Assad regime, the Houthis in Yemen. They've got blood on their hands of American soldiers in Iraq and in Lebanon. And none of this is being addressed in this framework. None of their bad behavior as a regional actor and a potential existential threat to our close ally Israel appears to not be addressed at all in this framework. So we do have 60 days in Congress to study the details of this agreement and provide an up or down vote to it. And I can promise you, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with my colleague making sure that we look through all the details of this and that we have a strong vote. If it is the bad deal that we think it's going to be, that we have a strong vote, because I am not of the group of people that you often hear the rhetoric of, this is the best deal we're going to get, and it's either this deal or it's going to war. I think that's really flawed logic, and a bad deal is certainly worse than no deal. And so we need to make sure that we do what's best for America and our national security and our close ally Israel.
I want to thank Congresswoman McSally for a great first answer. We will continue this conversation in a few moments when we come back here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can listen to all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivi non-Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
A festival is coming up, really not a festival, but a holy day, a commemoration, Tisha B'Av, the ninth of the Hebrew month of Av, which commemorates the destruction of both the first and the second temple and many other tragedies in Jewish history. For those of us living outside of Israel, it's a one-day fast day. Frankly, many liberal Jews don't even know it exists and certainly don't observe it. Even some Orthodox Jews maybe don't. But in Israel, it's an important festival, as it should be. Talk about Tisha B'Av in Israel.
So, yes, first of all, it's a day off from work in Israel. And it will start like Yom Kippur. It's like it's 2 days. So there is Eve, Erev Tisha B'Av,
right.
When we will have a special dinner.
Before it gets dark,
of course. Right. Special dinner. And it's before that, we have 9 days that most, it's very common that Israeli will not eat meat during these 9 days. So I have the special memory that I will eat fish, I don't know how do you say meatballs without, but for fish. So
fish balls
for like 9 days with special tomato sauce that my grandma, used to.
So 9 days in a row.
Everything related to food, right?
Right, of course.
So this
it's
is
Jewish.
My memory for
to food.
9 days before Tisha B'Av.
Even fast days are related to food in Judaism.
Nachon. So, and then, and I had a privilege just before I came here to spend Tisha B'Av Eve in the Kotel. So to read Megillat Echa, and it's a
right,
special,
the Scroll of Lamentations, which is chanted on the festival, both the evening
special.
And the morning.
It was special for me, to see everyone, it was packed, the Kotel, with people, and Jerusalem in general. So, and the next day is, most of the people won't work in Israel. It's at least day off. Yeah, it's a day off for sure. Even those who are not fasting, but so there is a special feeling in Israel. You will feel, and the TV shows will be different for sure. on all the three channel Israel channels in Israel, only things that related to Tisha B'Av, and no, for sure, no weddings, no nothing, no celebration, no concerts. So it's really, really special holiday, as you said, as it should be.
You know, I remember the first time I was in Israel for Tisha B'Av was I was 15 years old. And we went to the Kotel, and it was huge. And because it's a fast day, people stay up very late at night on Tisha B'Av. And they, you know, it's a powerful experience to be at the place where the destruction took place, you know, just Nahon. Below the Temple Mount there.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience. But it's also a time when you see lots of other people. You know, it's in
like Yom Kippur.
Like Yom Kippur.
We have the joke
yeah.
that if you didn't see your friend for a long time, go on Yom Kippur to synagogue, you will see him.
Yes, we have that joke here in America too, actually. So I think it's kind of like that. It becomes a social occasion, but also a very serious one, a very beautiful one. Thanks so much. We'll talk
Tada,
next week.
Bye.
And an easy fast.
Thank you. You too.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So last week was Bastille Day, and in honor of that, not really, but kind of, sort of, we were talking about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. We've seen a lot about it in France, and we talked for a while about the difference in demographics with the increasing Muslim population in Europe, now in some countries like France as much as 20%. Not so much a rise in anti-Semitism among ordinary Europeans, but among the large Muslim influx. There have been some people who have said that Islam is now conquering Europe demographically. That goes back to some historical pieces. Maybe we can explore that.
All right. Well, as you well know, and as many of your listeners know from previous shows, there was a point in history when the Arab Empire was expanding rapidly and threatened to include almost all of Europe. I mean, they got as far as the famous battle of either Poitiers or Tours or whatever. Nobody can agree. But Charles Martel supposedly saved Europe from the Muslims. But the Muslims did rule over the Iberian Peninsula for many centuries. And certainly there are a lot of Arab extremists today who consider Al-Andalus, which we would say Andalusia, as a lost province to be regained. And there are even other extremists who feel like all of Europe should be conquered because it is godless and secular and sinful, and that the way to ensure salvation for all these European Christians is to have them live under Sharia law. So I wouldn't say that the majority of Arabs in the world feel this way, or even that the majority of Muslims in the world feel this way, but there's a vocal minority, and the vocal minority has followers on the fringes of many of the societies that are threatened by this phenomenon of sort of revanchisme, of getting revenge for past losses. And, you know, people in the rest of the world have longer historic memories than we do. We've talked before about how in the Balkans, they're still fighting over issues that go back to the 14th century. All right. So apart from the Arab Empire that ruled over much of Southern Europe in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, there was also the Ottoman Empire that ruled over much of Southeastern Europe and, in fact, besieged Vienna in Central Europe.
A couple of times.
Several times in the course of the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, even into the 19th century, some big European cities that today we think of as Greek or Serbian or Bulgarian or Hungarian or whatever, were Turkish in the sense that the Ottomans were nominally Turks. This, of course, vastly predates the existence of modern Turkey. But there, too, there's a sense of the Ottomans on the rise again. And you can see physical signs of this in certain parts of the Balkans if you visit. We should probably come back to this again next week. And I think it's important to make a distinction not between ordinary Europeans and Muslim Europeans, but between Christian Europeans and Muslim Europeans.
And what that says for Jewish Europeans along the way. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day in the woods, a Jewish hiker suddenly sees a giant grizzly bear. The bear sees him too and starts to chase him. The guy manages to stay ahead for a while, but finally the bear corners him. Giving up all hope, knowing he is going to be eaten, the terrified hiker begins to sing the Shema, the last word a Jew says before death, Shema Yisrael. To his shock, the grizzly stops in front of him, and the bear too begins to recite Hebrew. Baruch atah Adonai Elokeinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, God, ruler of the world. The man is overjoyed. What were the odds he'd be chased by a Jewish bear? God is so good. How lucky he is. He's going to live. And then the hiker hears the bear's final words. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Thank you, God, who brings us food to eat. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and not get eaten. This week we begin the final book of the Torah, Dvarim, or Deuteronomy. The Greek-based name Deuteronomy captures a rabbinic explanation of the essence of this final book. It means a repeated text in Hebrew called Mishneh Torah. This reflects the fact that all of the book of Devarim is a few long sermons by Moses recapitulating the events and commandments established over the previous three books. There is no new material here officially, but it is well told. The narrative of Deuteronomy begins at the end of the Israelites' journey to the borders of Canaan, the Promised Land, soon to become Israel. Moses informs the people of Israel that he has now led them for 40 years, as though they might have forgotten that, and they have now come to a place and time of greatest importance. One of the first incidents, he recalls, goes back to the time when the Israelites were beginning to get organized, and Moses himself had just appointed judges and magistrates to help him with the needs of the people. Moses remembers the instructions he gave those leaders. Be fair and absolutely even-handed in dispensing justice. Do not favor the rich, do not favor the poor. Show no partiality. Simply seek that which is just and right in the world. This is, of course, just the beginning of Moses' long orations, his last hurrah, so to speak. Although he is now, by biblical calculation, 120 years old, though his control over his people has waned, even though his speech is tinged with the bitter knowledge that he will not be allowed to enter the promised land, still, Moses teaches us yet again the greatest lesson. We Jews must be pledged to create in this uncertain and unjust world acts and systems of ethics and justice. What greater calling can any people have? When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our special guest, Congresswoman Martha McSally, will explore the special relationship between Israel and America from the perspective of a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Hear all about it when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a week filled with news about the Iran nuclear agreement, two major Jewish political organizations have divided sharply on the issue. AIPAC called on Congress to reject the Iranian nuclear deal, saying it does not meet critical markers that the influential pro-Israel lobby has outlined in recent weeks. But simultaneously, the liberal Jewish Middle East lobby, J Street, announced a multi-million dollar campaign in support of the agreement. AIPAC made its case against the deal just an hour after President Barack Obama conducted a news conference defending the pact. We strongly believe that the alternative to this bad deal is a better deal, AIPAC said. Congress should reject the agreement and urge the administration to work with our allies to maintain economic pressure on Iran while offering to negotiate a better deal that will truly close off all Iranian paths to a nuclear weapon. Under the law, Congress can disapprove the deal. AIPAC's call to reject the agreement achieved between six world powers and Iran will make it likelier that Congress might send Obama a no, although it is unlikely that opponents will have the numbers to override the veto Obama has pledged to deliver. Disapproval requires a simple majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Overriding a veto takes two-thirds. Israel rejected the deal immediately and plans to lobby Congress to reject it. In a show of national unity, Yitzhak Herzog, the leader of the opposition Zionist Union Party in Israel, is coming to Washington this week to lobby against the deal. J Street announced its campaign that same day, saying it'll make the case to lawmakers that the agreement advances both U.S. and Israeli security interests. The lobby has raised $2 million for the campaign. J Street wants Congress to know that despite loud opposition to the deal coming from Jewish organizational leaders, our polling suggests a clear majority of Jewish Americans agree with us and back the deal. The campaign will launch this week with a 30-second TV ad highlighting the unprecedented inspections and monitoring of Iran's nuclear and military sites. President Obama asked lawmakers not to listen to lobbyists in considering the deal. In non-Iran news, by an overwhelming margin, Israel's Knesset voted down a bill that would allow judges to more easily sentence a terrorist to death. The vote was 94-6 against, and the bill was rejected in its first reading. The six votes in favor came from members of Yisrael Beitenu, the party that proposed the measure. In the March election, they ran on a platform that included death sentences for terrorists. It's not going to pass. In France, a court nullified a Paris suburbs decision to honor a Palestinian leader currently serving multiple life sentences in Israel for terrorism. The ruling by the Administrative Court of Montreux revoked the honorary citizenship conferred last year by the municipality of Aubervilliers on Marwan Barghouti, according to a report published by the National Bureau for Vigilance Against Antisemitism. The mayor of Aubervilliers announced the honor for Barghouti, a member of the Fatah faction, as part of his city's commitment to support political prisoners. The city statement compared Barghouti, the mastermind of dozens of deadly terrorist attacks that have murdered men, women, and children, compared Barghouti to the late Nelson Mandela of South Africa. Wow, really? The decision to honor Barghouti came shortly before a French court ordered another Paris suburb, Bizon, to nullify an honor conferred on Majdi Irimi al-Rimawi, the Palestinian who murdered Israeli tourism minister Rahavam Zevi more than a decade ago. Last month, the Seine-sur-Mer municipality in southern France announced that it plans to name a street after Yasser Arafat. Nice. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our special guest, Congresswoman Martha McSally, who represents Arizona's 2nd Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. I have to say, my congresswoman, serves on the Committees on Armed Services and Homeland Security, is the chair of the Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Communications. She served 26 years in the Air Force, retiring as a full colonel in 2010. First female fighter pilot to fly in combat, the first to command a fighter squadron in combat in all of United States history, and had an extensive experience, particularly in the Middle East, in combat and in training, and helped to change some of the most important policies in the Air Force. Tell us a little bit about your knowledge of Israel and your experience of the U.S. relationship with Israel so far.
Oh, absolutely. So thanks, Rabbi, for a great question. So I have had 6 deployments to the Middle East, and I've got 2 master's degrees focused on international security. And so I've had a deep understanding and respect and study of the dynamics in the Middle East, to include our special relationship with our close ally Israel. As a Christian myself, there is a deep religious connection, obviously, to Israel and the Israeli people. And so that's just a personal side of it. I've taken a trip over there myself to explore the Holy Land and be able to, walk on the grounds of such incredible history of mankind. And so that was a very personally moving for me to be able to, be on the Sea of Galilee. And I ran around the city, the old Jerusalem city, the walls in the morning. I get up early before everybody else, and I go and I would just spend some time just looking over these, like, just amazing historic places.
It's a fantastic place to run, isn't it?
It's
one of my
is.
Favorite places I've ever run in my life. It's amazing.
It really is. I mean, it's just, so much of our, our history is on those grounds. And so it was very personal for me to be there as a military officer. I also wanted to be able to see the security situation, firsthand, because it's one thing to study it, but it's another to actually see it, and see some of the challenges that Israel is having defending itself in such a small geographic area, surrounded by either enemies or instability. And so it was very important for me to be able to see that firsthand as well. And I'm actually heading on another trip in August with freshman members of Congress, now as a congresswoman, to, to spend the time over there to have the conversations with the different leaders in Israel related to, Israeli security, now as a congresswoman. So, look, Israel is our closest ally and the only democracy in the region, in an area that is crumbling around them. And, there are existential threats to Israel from Iran, but there's also significant, threats from just the instabilities on the other borders. And then you have this terrorist organization, Hamas, that's continuing to, kill civilians and engage in rocket attacks and trying to terrorize the Israeli people. So there are very serious and real security concerns of the Israeli people and those of us in America who are pro-Israel and want to make sure that Israel is defended. And we've got to do everything we can to do that. There's many facets to that. Our our military to military, you know, relationship is important. Our support to foreign military assets and foreign military sales and things like Iron Dome and other, you know, missile defense capabilities are working together to develop additional technologies in order to keep the Israeli people safe is so important. And we've got to make sure that we have a coherent strategy in the Middle East that is dealing with the threats around. And right now, look, this is not a partisan issue. This is about security. And right now, I just got off the floor of the House talking about what appears to be an incoherent strategy in the Middle East and sometimes quite conflicting. And our friends like Israel feel like they no longer can trust us and our enemies are no longer fearing us. And this is not a situation that we want to be in. And so as a strong voice of national security, I'm going to make sure that I am standing up and speaking strong and making sure we're providing oversight to the federal departments that are dealing with our foreign policy and our national security issues, because it's very, very concerning to me.
So as an expert on national security and some of the tremendous security challenges of the Middle East, Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, depending on which name you want to use, has emerged kind of shockingly in a short period of time as a very serious threat. Talk a little bit about that development. And, you know, I think sometimes we tend to think the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which isn't, of course, always the case.
Yeah, in this case, the enemy of our enemy is our enemy. So,
right.
Look, you know, ISIS had the dynamic of what has become ISIS has been growing and metastasizing over the last several years. And, you know, the latest decision that really impacted that, or the earliest decision, I would say, was us walking away from Iraq after so much blood and treasure was invested in. Look, we can debate and disagree or whatever on whether we should have been there in the first place. But what we can't have is a failed state in the middle of, in the middle of the Middle East. And so we were at a place where we had some level of stability, but then we walked away. At the same time, you know, we had red lines that were crossed and we didn't do anything related to the Assad regime in Syria. And so we had this vacuum created with the Sunni extremists taking advantage of it, both in Syria and Iraq. And so they were growing, they were building their resources, their territory. They were, you know, kidnapping people and extorting them and black market on the, you know, oil and continuing to grow. And then it really popped, I think, on the international stage about a year ago. But those of us who have been watching this dynamic happen, it didn't happen overnight. It was really growing over time. What they've done different from Al-Qaeda is they've taken advantage of social media and they've gained momentum. They have territory. They are more a franchise operation where they're trying to inspire people to conduct small-scale attacks instead of a top-down command and control approach and, delivering notes in caves with couriers. It's just a whole different level of Islamist extremism that is continuing to gain momentum both in the region, but then also around the world. Over 20,000 foreign fighters have flown into the region. Some of them have flown out, some from Western countries, from America as well. And then they're also just trying to inspire people on social media where they are. Right now, we've had almost 50 arrests in America since the beginning of the year of ISIS-inspired individuals that were planning and attempting to conduct attacks in their own communities in 19 different states. And so this gets back to the lack of coherent strategy in the region because we have Iran, Qasem Soleimani, who is the general responsible for leading the Quds Force, which is like basically a terrorist organization. They're running the ground forces in Tikrit while we're providing the air power. So we're actually kind of, you know, working alongside them while pretending that we're not, at the same time negotiating with them over their nuclear capability, at the same time, you know, fighting against them when they're supporting the Houthis in Yemen. And so this is totally incoherent. And so we've got to have a more coherent strategy in the Middle East to address ISIS. And we need a better military strategy. I've been very critical about us not using air power the way that we can use it in order to actually defeat and destroy them on the battlefield. Well, we also need to counter the violent extremism as root cause so that we can, you know, stop individuals from being recruited and radicalized.
So I've always heard that air power, while tremendously valuable, has some limitations. How should we be using air power to counter ISIS in ways that we're not right now?
So air power has the capability to be able to defeat and destroy command and control nodes, logistic nodes, communication nodes, and leadership or any sort of fighting forces that we may see that are like tending to take over another city, like we saw with Ramadi and some of the other recent attacks. And so we are limiting our use of air power because this administration is set the bar so high, way above what is required by international law and the law of armed conflict, that if they have a legitimate target, they want to basically, we don't want to kill any civilians. Trust me, I've been in the targeting process from being a fighter pilot all the way up to running the targeting operations in all of Africa. And we certainly want to minimize civilian casualties. But if we have legitimate targets where we know there's leadership, command nodes, resources, and we are not hitting them because we're concerned that one civilian might be killed, yet we're allowing ISIS to kill thousands of civilians because we're giving them free rein, then we really turned this logic on their head, and we are limiting ourselves to the point that we're being ineffective. So we could be using air power in a much stronger way in order to put them on their heels, to stop their momentum, to disrupt their logistics, to disrupt their command and control and communications. I believe we should be having additional special operations forces on the ground. I believe we should have air controllers on the ground. We call them JTAC that we work with, that we could embed in order to identify targets and talk into the aircraft. And we're not doing any of that. So we're in this gradualism approach that is sort of like what we're doing in Vietnam. And it looks like now ISIS is taking on America and winning. And that actually adds to their propaganda and their recruitment and their momentum. And we really need to stop that. And there's sort of this false choice that's been put out there that it's either air power or it's, you know, 100,000 boots on the ground.
Right.
And that's really not how we use our military. We need to make sure we use our air power in a way that can disrupt, defeat, and destroy ISIS capabilities without unnecessary restrictions, maximize the use of it. And we've already got ground forces there. I mean, they're advising and training. We need to use them in a way that takes advantage of our asymmetrical capabilities to use our power in the right way. We're in this counterinsurgency mindset where we're hoping we can prop up local, you know, Sunni forces in order to take back the region. And hope is not a strategy, the Secretary of Defense said to us in our committee hearing last week. But we're sort of sitting and waiting and hoping that they do that. And, you know, while Iraq has their own interests in addressing this in their country, we have our own national security interests and regional security interests that we need to make sure that we are fighting for. And we could be using air power in a much more capable way than we are right now. And it's adding to the psychology of them telling the world that they're winning, which doesn't help with the cause.
Certainly doesn't. I want to shift just a little bit. Israeli pilots have a great reputation. American pilots have a great reputation. So who's better?
Oh, well, you should never ask fighter pilots about who is the better fighter pilot, right?
Yeah, I have a follow-up question, but go ahead.
Yeah, right. So, look, I have the highest respect for those who serve in the IDF, and they absolutely have a tremendous reputation for their capabilities. So,
And I know here in Tucson, of course, there's a good deal of training. Some of it is even publicly acknowledged that goes on at the Air Force Base at Davis-Monthan here.
Absolutely. Yep, we take advantage of the Barry Goldwater ranges and the weather and the airspace here, which is what makes Davis-Monthan such a national security treasure, but really an international security treasure for our allies like Israel.
Israel has been a very close ally of the United States. It is fair to say that the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama, they're very unlikely to go golfing together anytime soon. Does that kind of a personal relationship really have a major role to play in foreign relations?
I think it does. And I agree with you. It is deeply strained. I'll tell you, one of the amazing opportunities I had in my first 6 months in Congress was to be on the floor of the House of Representatives when Prime Minister Netanyahu came to speak to us. I went down early to get an aisle seat so that I could greet him and speak with him on his way in and way out. And it was an absolute honor. But yeah, I mean, personal relationships really do matter because that's where trust comes from, right? And if you can't trust each other, then that is going to impact our nation's relationship with each other. And so I am very concerned about this strained relationship that has happened because of the activities or lack of effort by this administration that puts Israel in a position where they really feel like maybe they can't trust America, and we don't want to be in that situation. So I really think that the onus is on President Obama. I don't know whether it can be repaired, you know, in the next year and a half. But we have too much at stake in a very dangerous region, and it really the onus is on him in order to make sure that they have a better relationship than we've seen in the past.
Okay, and then a final question. I was forced to ask this by a close friend of mine and a friend of yours, I think, Kerry Marmis, who insists he was a better fighter pilot than you.
Yeah, every time when he introduces me, he's like, Marmis is the second best fighter pilot I know. Leave it to a typical fighter pilot, right? There's a lot of egos that go on in the fighter community, and Kerry's a good guy, so it's always funny banter, to be able to participate in that.
By the way, rabbis have egos too, last I heard. Thank you so much. We'll talk again.
Awesome. Thank you, Rabbi. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We appreciate it too. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Israeli author Edgar Keret, hottest voice on Israel's literary scene. Our playout this morning comes from Shmuley Ungar, performing a very fast freilach. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Im mit dem Villa heute die Kusche hat sich verklebt der Paroi Rusche Wird auf der Jeden sinken in der Trinken in dem Tacharam Weil an der Wie jetzt finde ich still